From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. We're going to spend the rest of this hour with a group of American opera singers working well outside their comfort zone. They've just spent a month in Beijing learning to sing modern Chinese opera. The I Sing Beijing program was funded by the Chinese government. But as NPR's Louisa Lim reports from Beijing, one man with a remarkable life story made it happen.
Lesson number one. Saying thank you in Chinese. For American soprano Maria McDaniel, this is the start of a linguistic journey into another culture. She's one of 20 American and European singers who recently spent a month in Beijing learning to sing modern Chinese operas.
There are no lips.
Oh, right, and it's very frontal.
Her days are packed with language lessons and one-on-one workshops. McDaniel says she's keen to explore China as a possible market of the future, given the dwindling opportunities for opera singers at home.
Many prominent opera companies have closed their doors. Much more have had to cut down on their seasons, the number of productions, and then the number of jobs are shrinking. So that was another reason that fueled my interest in coming over here and exploring.
She's learning to sing a role from a modern Chinese opera called Chinese Orphan. At the end of the month, each of the singers will perform an aria. They'll sing at the most prestigious venue in China, Beijing's National Center for the Performing Arts.
This is a very special day for me.
This is the brainchild of Hao Jiangtian, a Chinese opera singer who's made it on the international stage. Once a factory worker, he arrived in the U.S. penniless, knowing just three words of English. Within a decade, he was performing at the Met. He hopes this program will reduce the kind of discrimination he faced when he tried to break into opera in the West.
I had some terrible experiences with the directors, conductors, and the managers too, and because still, this is a Western opera, Western culture. The first rehearsal, if I don't know this conductor, director, my singing colleagues, and I could see lots of question marks in their eyes. This is Chinese. Can he sing?
Yet new contemporary Chinese music is having a bigger impact in the West. And Tian has premiered in a clutch of high-profile pieces, including The First Emperor of the Met, written by composer Tan Dun. Tian points out that China's economic boom is also creating a cultural boom.
Everybody knows the economy is really growing fast, so there are lots of money here and there, and so every city wants to become an international city, so they build an opera house. Government really put in lots of money for cultural events and developments.
With his program, Tian has come back to where he started. He takes the singers and a documentary crew to visit a Beijing boiler factory where he spent 6 years working on a steel cutting machine. As the cameras roll, together with his old colleagues, he belts out a forbidden American folk song, which back then they used to sing secretly. The most moving moment comes when a group of young factory workers start singing their factory anthem. This turns out to be Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. The new lyrics include a mention of how the company is burning its chest to warm the earth. The opera singers join in, their polished chorus providing the perfect counterpoint to the workers. At this moment, the two halves of Tian's life have come together. Maria McDaniel voices the mood.
This is only his second time returning here in 40 years. Can you imagine? It's a celebration of every kind. When I walked in, I felt so emotional because it was like to share a part of his journey like this, to celebrate how far he's come, I think is remarkable.
Tian has managed to secure Chinese government funding for I Sing Beijing, even though many of the big names involved are volunteering for free. True to its name, the official launch of I Sing Beijing is punctuated with outbreaks of song. This one welcomes guests from afar. The program's major funder was the Hanban, which is better known for setting up Confucius Institutes to teach Chinese language outside China. Asked about its soft power ambitions, the Institute's executive director, Xu Lin, said this.
Chinese people are now seen as rich country bumpkins without taste or culture. I'm trying to let the outside world know that China's 5,000 continuous years of culture is very attractive.
When it comes to understanding Chinese culture, tenor Thomas Glenn has one of the steepest learning curves. He's been assigned a much-loved Peking opera piece, The Siege of Tiger Mountain. But his first impressions of Peking opera weren't all that positive.
From our point of view and where our Western ears, it seems a very shrill, very monochromatic art form.
But by the time of the gala performance, he's had a month of masterclasses with a Peking opera star, Jiang Qihu. The audience is hugely appreciative. And Glenn says he's learnt a new respect for the art form.
To realise that these Peking opera singers study their whole lives to learn not only how to sing, but to dance, to do kung fu and their own makeup is very impressive. I can't say that I would ever become a Peking opera singer because it's very difficult to sing that type of music, but I certainly have a great respect for it.
On the big night, Maria McDaniel sings her aria from Chinese Orphan. By then, Hao Jiangtian is already looking ahead. And he has an inkling that that opera may be part of his next big project.
My dream is that someday I could help to cast a whole Western cast to sing a Chinese contemporary opera. Maybe next year.
So the first day of your program, when you said my dream has come true.
Yes.
In fact, now 10 days later, your dream has already changed and become bigger and different.
Dream, that's the beauty of a dream, is because every night could be different.
One man's dream of promoting intercultural understanding is overlapping with a larger official dream of showcasing modern China's cultural strengths. At the gala concert, the success of the I Sing Beijing program is clear, and nowhere more so than during the finale, a heartfelt rendition by the chorus of Westerners of one of China's most famous songs. Its name, I Love You, China. Louisa Lim, NPR News, Beijing.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Now, a talk with Thomas Friedman, the New York Times columnist, about his new book. But first, this historical analogy made on this program earlier this year by Paul Otellini, the CEO of Intel. Our country's situation today, Otellini said, is like Britain's situation at the turn of the last century.
The UK, 100 years ago, was where America was. I imagine sitting in Britain 110 years ago, looking at the rising giant of the United States, the buildings going up and the new factories and the schools and the universities, and they must have been saying, oh my God. And in fact, the U.S. eclipsed the U.K. and most of Europe. Well, we're sitting here today looking over the next ocean, the Pacific this time, and the infrastructure being built out in Asia, not just China, but across Asia. And we should be appropriately saying, oh my God.
Oh my God could well have been the title of the new book that Thomas Friedman and Michael Mandelbaum have written. It's called That Used to Be Us, How America Fell Behind in the World It Invented and How We Can Come Back. Tom Friedman, welcome to the program.
Great to be with you, Robert.
What you're describing here is a country that used to be industrially advanced, exceptionally inventive, unusually educated, politically pragmatic, relatively egalitarian. Today we look around and say, That used to be us. Other countries are more like that now.
Well, there's no question we've lost our way, Robert. And what Michael and I argue in the book is that it's really the product of three big things. It's not the 2008 subprime crisis. This problem started at the end of the Cold War. We made the biggest mistake a country or species can make. We misread our environment. We thought the Cold War was a victory and we could put our feet up. In fact, we had just unleashed a world of 2 billion people just like us. People with our same aspirations, same capabilities. And just when we needed to be lacing up our shoes and running faster, we put our feet up. We compounded it then, I would add, with a decade, unfortunately, tragically, after 9/11, mm-hmm. where we ended up chasing the losers from globalization for 10 years, Al-Qaeda, rather than the winners.
We were preoccupied, you would say, with the wrong rivals during this past decade. Some people might argue this point or that about our decline, but let's stipulate that your description of the national funk or the decline that we're in is accurate. Why? What was going through our minds over the past 20 years that vetoed an older impulse to say, hey, we have to compete economically, we have to save and invest, we have to pay for what we do?
Well, as I say, there was a third factor, and that was a generational change. We shifted from a greatest generation that really operated on what we call in the book sustainable values, saving and investing. And we handed power over to the baby boomer generation who really lived by situational values, borrow and consume. And I think that shift has been a key factor.
But to some extent, we have seen the enemy, and he is... He's our generation.
Oh, it's definitely. The baby boomers, I believe, have a lot to answer for. They have not followed in the path of their parents in terms of making the hard decisions, making the long-term investments. Doubly important at this time of huge technological change. Let me just say a few words about that because it's very important. You know, the world after the Cold War didn't just get connected. It got hyper-connected. And when it did, we were exposed to competition from so many more people, so many more machines, and so many more robots. You know, Robert, I wrote a book and I started in 2004 called The World is Flat. And as I started working on this book, I went back and I reread The World is Flat. Mm-hmm. And I actually looked in the index, first edition, under F. And I realized Facebook wasn't in it. When I wrote The World Was Flat, when I said, the world is flat, you know, we're all connected. Facebook didn't exist. Twitter was a sound. The cloud was in the sky. 4G was a parking place. LinkedIn was a prison. Applications were what you sent to college. And Skype, for most people, was a typo. All of that changed in just the last 6 years.
But here's a problem with the very flatness that you've written about. Your book, the problem it's addressing, is a national concern. You're writing about this country. And I wonder, when you talk to CEOs of large companies whose markets, shareholders, increasingly their labor force, are global and not confined to this country, whether they're on board with the national project, or does the very flat world that you've written about mean that the production of wealth by American-based companies just doesn't benefit as many Americans as it used to, and it may never?
I think that's exactly right. You see, American multinationals today, those big companies we think about, Robert, they actually aren't in America. They hover over America. And we are missing, actually, the voices of those CEOs in our discussions today, our national discussions on education and infrastructure, because if they can't get the workers, the infrastructure, the opportunities they need here, they can just go somewhere else. And that's a huge problem. But I think it gets to what needs to be our vision going forward? There's kind of a hankering today. When is Ford going to put in that 50,000 worker factory in my city again? When is Intel going to come? Paul Otellini. Folks, it's not going to happen because those factories now are all incredibly roboticized, automated, and they are capital intensive, not labor intensive. We're not going to have a 50,000 person factory in your town. What we need are 50,000 people, 1,000 of whom are starting jobs for 10 people, 50 of whom for 100, 100 of whom for 30, that everybody needs to be starting something.
But many of the remedies that you write about here are good in theory, but say having more and better teachers or a National Academy of Teachers is a proposal you're making in a season when in fact we're laying off teachers. A balanced approach to solving our fiscal problems is something you write about, and we know what the stalemate is in Washington. How do you get from where we are right now to solutions that might indeed address our national problems. What do you do?
Well, we understand the political system is gridlocked. Hmm? You know, I would argue one of our political parties, the Republican Party today in particular, and we are independents, this is not a political book, but they've really gone off the rails in a certain way. And that's why, you know, if you look at what's going on today, Robert, in America, we're having an economic crisis and the politicians are having an election. And it's like they don't even overlap. And what we argue is that's because the incentives of politics today, money, gerrymandered districts, are so misaligned with the needs of the country that they become like a closed circle operating on their own. And something's got to break through that. And what we argue for is an independent third party that actually can show that there is a huge middle in this country that demands a different politics.
You go out of your way to end on an upbeat note in the book and say that you – do you really feel optimistic? I mean, do you really look around at Washington and the economy and say, yeah, we're going to come out of this okay?
Drugs, Robert. A lot of drugs.
you're self-medicating.
No, it's look, I am truly an optimist. And the reason – we don't just end on an optimistic note. We end on a long discussion about what makes us optimists. It's because this country is full of people – today who just didn't get the word. They just didn't get the word that we're down and out. They just didn't get the word that Washington is paralyzed. And they go out and start stuff and invent stuff and fix stuff and make stuff no matter what's going on in Washington.
Tom Friedman, thanks for talking with us.
Pleasure.
Thomas Friedman and Michael Mandelbaum are the authors of That Used to Be Us, How America Fell Behind in the World It Invented and How We Can Come Back.
This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm David Green. Again and again, President Obama's White House has promised that now he'll focus on jobs.
Again and again, he's been pulled off course, often by disasters, both natural and political.
This week, the president is focusing on jobs, and that will include a speech before Congress.
In Detroit yesterday, the president stood next to Jimmy Hoffa, the Teamsters union leader, who spoke of the debate over the economy as a war. And the president previewed parts of his plan to create jobs. NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
President Obama acknowledges these are tough times for working people and tougher still for the millions who aren't working. Even so, Mr. Obama tried to strike an upbeat tone. Speaking outside the General Motors Renaissance Center in Detroit yesterday, he said the middle class is overdue for a renaissance of its own.
I don't know about you, but I'm not scared of tough times. I'm not scared of tough times because I know we're going to be all marching together and walking together and working together and rebuilding together, and I know we don't quit.
R-E-S-P-C-T. R-E-S-P-C-T.
Thousands of people had assembled in the GM parking lot to hear the president and his warm-up act, Aretha Franklin. Many in the crowd were proudly sporting union T-shirts. AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka says Labor Day is a good opportunity to show respect for Teamsters and teachers and other working people.
Thank you to the auto workers who made the cars and trucks that brought us here today.
One of those auto workers was tapped to introduce the president. Ghana Goodwin Dodd works at a GM plant that would have closed were it not for the automaker's government rescue 2 years ago.
Thank you, President Obama, for having the courage to stand up for the American worker and the American auto companies.
Today, both GM and Chrysler are making money again and enjoying double-digit sales gains. The rescue of the automakers is typical of the economic moves Mr. Obama made during his first year in office when the recession was at its worst. Big, bold, sometimes politically unpopular. More recently, Mr. Obama's been more cautious and more focused on deficit reduction. With Republicans in control of the House, he's also had less room to maneuver. Now, with the economy stalling again, labor leaders like Trumka say it's time for another round of aggressive government jobs action. And Mr. Obama hints part of the plan he'll unveil on Thursday is a new push for spending on public works.
We've got more than 1 million unemployed construction workers ready to get dirty right now. There is work to be done, and there are workers ready to do it. Labor is on board. Business is on board. We just need Congress to get on board. Let's put America back to work.
Mr. Obama has also been calling for a renewal of the payroll tax cut to preserve workers' take-home pay and their buying power. He's practically daring congressional Republicans to vote against it.
You say you're the party of tax cuts? Well, then prove you'll fight just as hard for tax cuts for middle-class families as you do for oil companies and the most affluent Americans. Show us what you got.
Mr. Obama has sometimes disappointed his union supporters, failing to push through a bill to make it easier to organize, for example. But yesterday, he defended organized labor as crucial for a strong middle class, and he challenged those Republicans who've been pushing to limit collective bargaining rights.
And I want everybody here to know, as long as I'm in the White House, I'm going to stand up for collective bargaining.
Just how long Mr. Obama is in the White House could depend on the enthusiasm he's able to generate among working families, both unionized and not. The organized workers at yesterday's rally were cheering him on with chance of four more years. Scott Horsley, NPR News.
All right, this is the final month of operation for a massive and sophisticated piece of scientific machinery. It is designed to help scientists understand what makes up the universe at its most basic level. It smashes bits of atoms together and then sifts through the tiny bits of subatomic rubble. For a quarter of a century, it was the most powerful machine that did that. NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce reports on the end of the Tevatron and what American scientists hope will replace it.
About an hour west of Chicago is the Fermi National Accelerator Laboratory. Fermilab covers a little more than 10 square miles, and on the surface seems like a nature preserve. There's woods, a herd of buffalo, and acres of restored prairie.
Wow, look, it's beautiful. I didn't even know about these flowers. Look at this.
A physicist named Dmitry Denisov walks up wooden steps to the top of something that looks like an abandoned railroad bed.
The first time I came here was 1989. And I came as a young sort of scientist from Soviet Union.
Denisov came because of what he's standing on, the Tevatron. This tall mound of dirt stretches off into the distance. It forms a huge circle, nearly 4 miles around. Beneath it is a tunnel, a high-tech racetrack for protons and antiprotons. They accelerate to almost the speed of light, then slam together. Their collisions spew out the hidden particles that make up matter.
I remember sort of coming to this point, looking, they say, wow, that's really a big machine.
At the time, the biggest in the world. Denisov is not the only scientist who was drawn here by the power of the Tevatron to probe the building blocks of the universe. This is where the elusive top quark was discovered and where theories get tested. In one windowless control room filled with dozens of computer screens, researchers monitor subatomic collisions 24 hours a day. On the cinder block wall, there are clocks showing time zones across the world, because so many researchers came here from abroad.
For example, in India or in Russia or in Vietnam or in China. So it's a little bit of just to make people feel more at home here in our control room at Fermilab.
But at the end of September, this homey control room will go dark. In a special ceremony, officials will shut down the Tevatron. It's been made obsolete by the Large Hadron Collider near Geneva, Switzerland. Its circular racetrack for particles is 17 miles around. Denisov says this new collider is now the big draw for the world's physicists.
And many people, including people who work here at the Tevatron, are moving where the science is.
Scientists here do still hope to make one last big discovery in the few weeks the Tevatron has left about a particle also being chased in Europe.
The big thing going on right now in terms of particle physics is the so-called race for the Higgs boson.
That's Tevatron physicist Rob Roser. He says the Higgs is a particle that could explain one of the big mysteries of science, why things have mass.
So we're just hanging on, trying to get every last collision we can before we turn off to see whether we can make a statement, an important statement about it.
So it sounds like, you know, you all are wanting to sort of go out with a bang, as it were.
We want to go out sprinting across the finish line, not crawling, yes.
Even so, the end is looming for the Tevatron. And researchers are reminded of that every time they go to have lunch. Right next to the main cafeteria at Fermilab is a new control room with a glass wall. Through it, you can see monitors linked to the Large Hadron Collider. This is so scientists can run experiments remotely on the huge European machine, which the United States contributed money to help build.
It's a very important part of the American program to actually exploit the Large Hadron Collider.
Pierre O'Donnell is the director of Fermilab.
I would say the mood of the community is that this is a unique time in the history, that we're opening a regime where all of a sudden we have access to 10 times the energy that we could produce here at the Tevatron.
That doesn't mean American scientists don't feel sad at losing the status that comes with having the world's best physics machine. O'Donnell would like to see the next big thing built right here. But that's no easy task when budgets are shrinking for the physical sciences. After all, Europe's Large Hadron Collider cost around $10 billion.
It just simply seems very difficult, given debt issues, deficits, and all of that, to ask for the required increases that we would need to build the biggest machine.
So instead of a bigger machine that can produce even more powerful collisions, they hope to build something different, a new machine that would produce a record number of collisions. Having lots and lots, even if they're less powerful, should let scientists see rare events that hardly ever happen.
Things that happen, you know, 1 out of 10 to the 17th times, which is, you know, I don't know, it's like a billion or something. So it's things that happen really, really rarely.
Steve Holmes leads the team working towards the proposed new accelerator, which they're calling Project X. He showed me a long concrete bunker painted mint green. Inside it, scientists are testing new technologies needed for Project X. It would cost a couple $1 billion and would do things the collider in Europe can't. It would be the best facility in the world for studying tricky particles like neutrinos.
As long as, you know, there's a commitment in the U.S. to be a world player in particle physics, which I got to believe there is, Project X is going to have to be built.
Holmes says if Project X gets funding, it could be built by the end of this decade, and he hopes it will.
You know, we don't always have to be number one. It's natural that the lead goes back and forth across the ocean, but I think we always got to be in a position when the lead went someplace else, we've got a plan to get it back here.
Once the Tevatron shuts down, it won't be disassembled right away. Instead, its tunnel will be opened up to the public as a kind of museum to let people see the vast equipment that once revealed incredibly tiny parts of the universe. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Jackie Lydon. Michelle Martin is away. Everyone's refreshed and ready for school, new school supplies in hand, but some Wisconsin teachers feel like they've lost their most powerful tool, bargaining rights. The Wisconsin legislature voted for extensive budget cuts last winter. One part of the infamous bill stripped public employees of the right to collectively bargain. We'll speak with a Republican state senator who voted for it in a few moments. But first, we turn to a teacher affected by that law. And while teachers' unions still have a say in their salaries, many of them believe that that's not enough. With us now is Wisconsin teacher Hedy Eichscheid. She's taught for 20 years and has also served as union president in her school district in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So, Hedy, you're going to be teaching fifth grade again this year. But when this law was proposed in February, you were working part-time as union president and part-time as curriculum support teacher. What was it like for you and your colleagues to go to work while that fight was going on, that very public, very televised fight?
Well, Jackie, it was an extremely, extremely emotional time for all of us. We were under attack like we have never felt in this profession before. The degree to which the public venom came out against us was pretty astonishing to many, and it was a very emotional time to feel so attacked. And it was difficult.
Hedy, the bill ended up going into law at the end of June, right after you began summer vacation. And teachers who are in the union, which is the Wisconsin Teachers Education Association, WEAC, how quickly did your school district feel the consequences?
Well, we're in a very unique situation from my perspective here in this district for quite some time. We had bargained collaboratively and worked collaboratively with the district for more than a decade. We had had a phenomenal relationship in where, you know, the association and the district worked extremely well together, and we made decisions collectively that was in the best interest of the district, the employees, the kids, teaching and learning, it was really a pretty great place to be. We worked real hard to try to get our school board to go back to the bargaining table because we as an association were interested in having a contract extension so we could maintain our right to collectively bargain. That was to no avail. And within almost 24 hours after the contract expired, we received a letter from our superintendent making some pretty dramatic changes to what it is we had known, particularly with our workday.
And can you give us a brief summary of what those are?
Certainly. We expected to have the monetary concessions. Our state leaders said that we would be willing to give those long ago, and we as an association, when we were urging the district to go back to the table, said we were absolutely willing to talk about the monetary concessions, which were the insurance piece and the WRS piece. The piece that really surprised all of us was an additional hour that was added to our day. And it concerned us for a couple of reasons. One, the way in which it was done. Why we received it in a letter. It was a letter that everybody got right around the 4th of July, and it was just, you know, the way the message was delivered was just people felt very disrespected. And there was no involvement on the part of the association, none whatsoever. So this really set us back on our heels.
Hedy, will losing collective bargaining rights really affect the quality of teaching for those teachers that are good at what they do?
I believe that when an employee, any employee, doesn't have meaningful say in their work environment, the quality of their work suffers. There's been a lot of research done in organizational development and in systems, and it's pretty clear that when employees are involved in the decision-making process and they feel like their opinion matters, you do get a better product. And now our product is students. And when teachers in the classroom feel as though they are on a daily basis, consistently and regularly told what to do, without asking their opinion, the people who are in those classrooms on a daily basis working with those kids, they do feel demoralized. They don't feel respected. That, I believe, is going to have a negative consequence.
Wisconsin isn't doing too badly, Hedy. Right now, the state ranking is 18 nationwide, 18 out of 50 states. But last week, nearly 5,000 Wisconsin teachers took early retirement between January of 2011 and July, which is double the rate of the previous year. So you talked about morale. Do you think that the new law is part of the reason that retirement has risen?
Absolutely. I absolutely do. And it was a very, very painful decision, an emotional decision for many of the people. We had 43 retirements in our district here in Fond du Lac of 535 teachers. I do believe that morale was an issue. People felt throughout this process that they just weren't respected as professionals. And given the chance and given the fact that many of them could leave, unfortunately, many decided to go.
What's your response to the argument that unions protect bad teachers?
Unions protect and ensure due process. And if process is followed, there are teachers that have been removed, that have been placed in different assignments, that have been asked to resign, that we protect due process that every employee should have.
What do you think the coming year is going to be like? Do you think unions are becoming obsolete, or is there another way that teachers' rights might be protected?
I don't believe unions are becoming obsolete. I think that we are going to begin to see, as the year goes on, the reason why we had protections in place for people. When you have people making decisions who don't spend their daily lives in a classroom and they don't then include the people who spend their daily lives in those classrooms, you're going to have a lot of unintended consequences take place. You know, I think it's going to be a year of constant change, a year of a lot of firsts. I'm hopeful that in the end, here in Fond du Lac, the district and the association can try to find their way back together to where we were. I'm not certain how interested the district is in continuing that kind of relationship with us, but I know we're very interested because we don't like the way it is now, and we'd like to see it back to the way it was.
Hedy Eichscheid is a fifth-grade teacher in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin. She was kind enough to join us for an update on the teachers' unions there. Well, have a good school year, Hedy. Thank you.
I appreciate that, Jackie.
It's a soggy day nine at the U.S. Open, so Andy Murray, Rafael Nadal, and Andy Roddick, among others, will have to wait out the rains. We're joined from Flushing Meadows by Douglas Robson. He covers tennis for USA Today. He joins us at the Filing Center there in Queens. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So when will today's games be played, or will they even be played today?
No, there's going to be no tennis today. They've canceled the day and night session, so they're going to have to back up the schedule and try to get it going tomorrow. But the forecast is not very promising, and this kind of thing can really wreak havoc at a tennis tournament.
So we have no choice but to talk about the games yesterday, and let's start with the women. Serena Williams moved on to the quarterfinals, and so did Caroline Wozniacki. On TV, Serena seemed to play with a vengeance, and Wozniacki, though it took her three sets, seemed like a cat who was almost toying with her prey. That's what it looked like, at least on television. Tell us what you saw there in Queens.
Caroline Wozniacki comes in as the number one player in the world. She is criticized for not having a great forehand, for having a suspect serve, but you saw in a gutsy performance against a very tough player, Kuznetsova, that she can toy with even the best of them. She changed her tactics midway through the second set. She was down a set, down 4-1, and by the end of the match, you know, Kuznetsova looked like she was slogging through mud. She was sweating. She couldn't keep the ball on the court. And Wozniacki looked fresh as a daisy. Looked like she could go a couple more sets, and she even said so afterwards.
And Serena, even with all these injuries, has come back extremely strong. I mean, she just had two-foot surgeries.
Yeah, Serena's march through the draw here has a sense of inevitability about it. She is focused. She's locked in. You know, there were times in Serena's career when it felt like she wasn't sure if she wanted to be a tennis player. She dabbled in acting. She dabbled in the red carpet scene. But she had these two foot surgeries. She had these medical setbacks, a pulmonary embolism, blood clots. She had a hematoma surgery in her stomach. Her third round opponent, Victoria Azarenka, said it was painful to play her. And her next opponent in her last round, Anna Ivanovic, just talked about how intimidating it is to see her across the net.
So let's talk about the men's side. If you were interested in that play, you had to stay up really late.
You did. Roger Federer took the court close to midnight last night, but he was completely unperturbed, and he's the consummate pro. He went out there, he took care of business, he completely dismantled his opponent. And afterwards he said, you know, no big deal. You know, I know people pay a lot of money to sit in these seats. I'm an entertainer. You know, he gets it, and he's looking sharp.
One of the things that really stands out here is the strength of the U.S. men. They're doing much better than expected.
They are indeed. We had four men reach the fourth round here for the first time since 2003. Andy Roddick, Marty Fish, who's bowed out yesterday, John Isner, the 6'10 fire cannon server, and Donald Young, a young 22-year-old. He now seems to be sort of taking his talent to the next level, and it's really nice to see the U.S. men having a nice run here in New York.
Douglas Robson, good to talk to you. Thanks so much.
Nice to be here.
Douglas Robson writes about tennis for USA Today. More coming up on All Things Considered.